Hello and welcome to Spoilers, this first introduction to the play The Tragedy of Marion by Elizabeth Carey. In the following episodes, there will be introductory notes, followed by a plain text recording of the dialogue, a plain text being the first cut edit of our full cast audio recording. It has all the text, but no SFX, no Foley, and it's the edit we use to hunt out textual errors, retakes, or cuts. So it's not perfect, and we may change the take for the final thing. If you want to just enjoy our production in the future as a thing in itself, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the full cast episode further up the podcast list. But if you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land. Spoiler land! Yes. Act 1 of Marion is fabulous. It really is everything you ever wanted in a sort of neoclassical way kind of thing. It's got a single place setting, rotating characters whose entrances don't feel forced, whose interaction moves the story forward piece by piece. This isn't really that sort of play once you get out of Act 1. Though the general location and time are the same, everything effectively happens in the course of one day within a single general location, even though the scenes clearly happen in different places once you're out of Act One. Yes, some of the speeches are a little long, but that's why God invented blue pencils. Never complain when a script has too much material, only when there are pieces missing. I would argue that if there is anything wrong with this first act, dramaturgically, it's simply that it's far too good and it makes the rest of the play feel bad. Now, my comments are mostly based on questions arriving from doing the play now as an audio piece and having worked on it as a reading in the past. So, some of my questions or viewpoints are really unfair to the time of its composition. We're going to be asking questions about how it would play to an audience now, and some of the language and themes undergo a transition because of doing it now, and it might be unfair to the original intention of the playwright to overlay certain ideas and thoughts onto it, but tough. That's what happens when you do a production to people alive now. So, Act 1's made up of long speeches, getting at the inner truth of a character, or at least their viewpoint of truth, interspersed by exchanges where characters largely have a go at each other, based on those inner thoughts. It's an act that sets the scene of the play. There's no prologue in the action. It deals with the setup and the backstory, but no one actually does anything. They talk about doing things, they talk about the options they now have, but in a sense it is quite static. That doesn't mean in performance it is. Now, I've said long speeches and nothing happens, but that's not to say that this isn't wonderful meat to get into. If there is too much meat, well, what can you do? It opens with our protagonist. Or does it? Yes, it does. It's Marion. And she is not sure how to react to some news.
How oft have I with public voice run on to censure Rome's last hero for deceit, because he wept when Pompey's life was gone. Yet when he lived, he thought his name too great.
So the play throws you in to a proposition that isn't fully articulated. You're sort of expected to get that she's talking about Julius Caesar here. She's previously criticised Julius Caesar, as I say, unhelpfully unnamed in this opening gambit, for crying at the defeat of his enemy. But now Marion finds herself in the same situation. She's crying at the outset of the play because of the probable death of her husband, who she should hate.
How oft have I with public voice run on to censure Rome's last hero for deceit, because he wept when Pompey's life was gone. Yet when he lived, he thought his name too great. But now I do recant. And, Roman lord, excuse too rash a judgment in a woman. My sex pleads pardon, pardon then afford. Mistaking is with us but too common.
So, let's be clear. Do not expect Mariam to necessarily be a feminist cheerleader. There might be some internalized sexism here that might be part of the intention of the author. That doesn't necessarily mean the play in its reading today will read that way. There's a very diverse set of characters set in opposition in this play, and it's really interesting how they intersect. But in a sense, for a opening gambit by our title character, it's perhaps a little disappointing for the audience to hear that she buys into some clichés of what women are. But don't worry, other characters don't.
Now do I find, by self-experience taught, one object yields both grief and joy. You wept indeed when on his worth you thought, but joyed that slaughter did your foe destroy.
Mariam is caught between emotions. Her husband, Herod, is reported dead. How should she feel? Should she feel grief or joy? And it's both. It gives the actor so many options when playing this scene. Now, this take is fairly restrained. For the spoilers version, I usually use quite a plain cut. But the actor can take it to extremes, can keep it small, can make it big, directions changing left, right and centre. And Mariam puts forward the case in this speech against Herod. For starters, he drove her love away.
Oft have I wished that he might lose his breath. Oft have I wished his carcass dead to see. Then rage and scorn had put my love to flight. That love which once on him was firmly set. Hate hid his true affection from my sight, and kept my heart from paying him his debt.
And yet, there were good times.
But now Herod's death to memory doth call, the tender love that he to Mariam bare, and mine to him. This makes those rivers fall.
And yet, and Mariam is building up Herod's faults here stage by stage, he did murder her brother.
For my brother, the lowliest youth that ever did in angel's shape appear, the cruel Herod was not moved to ruth. Then why grieves Mariam Herod's death to hear?
And this genuinely puzzles her. The play really does wrestle with the fact that emotions are not linear, that how we should feel doesn't always match our experience, that emotions can come in contradictory waves. Again, this gives the actors all the tools to play with, to let this long speech breathe, shifting in its pace and tone. Oh, and he didn't just kill a brother, he also killed a grandfather.
And worthy grandsire, ill did he requite his high ascent, alone by thee procured, except he murdered thee to free the sprite, which still he thought on earth too long immured.
How did Mariam survive this slaughter? Well, bit more plot, she had an ally, Sohemus.
How happy was it that Sohemus' mind was moved to pity my distressed estate? Might Herod's life a trusty servant find? My death to his had been unseparate.
Sohemus will turn up later. And if you are feeling a little confused about the backstory, you can always go back and listen to episode 1 of these spoilers, where we cover the plot before the play starts. So this speech bounces between her experiences of her husband Herod, putatively dead, from good to bad, and ends with a cue line, designed to tell the next actor to enter the stage, because she mustn't be seen to cry before her mother, Alexandra.
But, tears, fly back and hide you in your banks. You must not be to Alexandra seen. For if my moan be spied, but little thanks shall Mariam have from that incensed queen.
Little thanks indeed, for lo, Alexandra enters and immediately lays into Mariam. I really like Alexandra as a character. I'm not going to say that I like her. If in real life I met her, she's a horrible person in many, many ways. But she's well drawn enough to really like her as something to play with in a dramatic situation. Though, sadly, this is the only time we will see her. As I say I like, she's really horrid in many ways, but there is so much potential in her only scene. I think everyone has had a difficult time with a parent, and Mariam's relationship with her mother is tricky. On seeing Mariam cry, Alexandra goes,
"What means these tears? My Mariam doth mistake the news we heard did tell the tyrant's end. What weepest thou for thy brother's murderer's sake?"
Well, I mean, it's a good question, to be fair. Alexandra has lost her father and one of her children. And if she stopped there, I think we would view this scene quite differently. But in her rage, Alexandra keeps going.
"Will ever whiter tear for Herod spend? My curse pursue his breathless trunk and spirit, base Edomite, the damned Esau's heir. Must he heir Jacob's child, the crown, inherit?"
So she's a snob. Herod isn't dynastically pure. He's not from as good a family as Alexandra and Mariam.
"Must he, vile wretch, be set in David's chair? No."
Here we should also remember this is being inflicted on Mariam, who knows that this is the sort of thing her mother says all the time.
"He ever thirsts for blood, and blood is red."
And perhaps the audience might give Alexandra some scope in this, because she is clearly grieving for her son and father. And Mariam is grieving, crying for the murderer.
"Weepest thou because his love to thee was bent, and readest thou love in crimson characters? Slew he thy friends to work thy heart's content?"
And for those not paying attention, she goes over the plot details of those deaths again. But then she turns those murders on Mariam again, and even throws up the political angle. Because Herod clearly hates the family line that Mariam descends from.
"And this his hate to thee may justly prove that sure he hates Hyrcanus' family."
"Don't weep for him," she says. "He might turn back to his ex-wife, Doris."
"Who knows if he, unconstant wavering lord, his love to Doris had renewed again? And that he might his bed to her afford, perchance he wished that Mariam might be slain."
Now, let us ignore the slightly jarring quality of the name Doris. It was her name in history, and it does jar a bit in the modern ear. When I first did this play, I slightly changed the pronunciation, trying to strange it a bit, making it Doris, which sort of worked, and then also sort of didn't. Anyway, Mariam has no fear that Doris is an issue.
"Doris? Alas, her time of love was past. Those coals were raked in embers long ago, in Mariam's love, and she was now disgraced. Nor did I glory in her overthrow. He not a whit his first..."
And there's a weird pride element to Mariam's response there. I mean, he fancied me more than Doris. I mean, I like this detail, and some more to come, because otherwise Mariam might come across as a saintly figure without any reproach. Whereas the more you look, the more compromised Mariam is, like all the characters in this play. They're all compromised in different ways. So Alexandra is someone who has right on her side in terms of the death of her children, or her son and her father, but who is really horrible in so many other ways. Mariam thinks she's safe because of her children. There's this pride element again. They're boys. They are clearly in the line of succession. And their union with Herod and Mariam, his power and her descent from David, means that they are destined to be safe.
"My Alexander, if he live, shall sit in the majestic seat of Solomon."
"My Alexander, if he live." Ooh, that's a dangerous thought. And Alexandra leaps on it. Their family should be kings and queens, regardless of Herod. She defies the whole proposition.
"Did Herod think it fit?"
"Why, who can claim from Alexander's brood that gold-adorned, lion-guarded chair? Was Alexander not of David's blood? And was not Mariam Alexander's heir? What more than right could Herod then bestow? And who will think, except for more than right, he did not raise them? For they were not low, but born to wear the crown in his despite.
And now Alexandra goes off on my favourite tangent, because it gave us the key to who she is and who I've hinted at she is so far. It tells us in greater detail how she ended up as the character we see. So, Alexandra, she wanted Mariam or her brother to marry Mark Antony, deceased, and that didn't come off. This tangent follows from Mariam's tears, because if she looks sad at the good news of Herod's death, it will upset Felicity. Felicity as a god with power over our lives.
Felicity, if when she comes, she finds a mourning habit and a cheerless look, will think she is not welcome to thy mind, and so perchance her lodging will not brook.
Alexandra has long worshipped Felicity. She was part of so many of her plans for her family.
Oh, keep her whilst thou hast her. If she go, she will not easily return again. Full many a year have I endured in woe, yet still have sued her presence to obtain.
So her plan was to send two pictures to Mark Antony, to tempt him to love her children and favour and or marry them.
And did not I to her as presents send a portrait that best art did beautify of two, to whom heaven did best feature lend to woo her love by winning Antony? For when a prince's favour we do crave, we first their minions' loves do seek to win. So I, that sought Felicity to have, did with her minion Antony begin.
So, if Antony, also a favourite of Felicity, liked their picture, he would favour them. And she, hedging her bets, presumably because she knew Mark Antony was a bit bisexual, sent pictures of both Mariam and her brother together.
With double sleight I sought to captivate the warlike lover, but I did not right. For if my gift had borne but half the rate, the Roman had been overtaken quite.
Disaster! She should only have sent one picture. He couldn't decide who to go for. They were both so beautiful.
But now he fared like a hungry guest that to some plenteous festival is gone. Now this, now that he deems to eat were best. Such choice doth make him let them all alone.
Do I go for the boy's forehead, or forehead, or Mariam's cheek?
The boy's large forehead first did fairest seem, then glanced his eye upon my Mariam's cheek, and that without comparison did deem what was in either but he most did like.
Antony couldn't decide, so he chose neither.
And thus distracted, either's beauties might within the other's excellence was drowned. Too much delight did bear him from delight, for either's love the other's did confound.
And this has hung heavy in the lists of disappointments in Alexandra's life. If only!
Where if thy portraiture had only gone, his life from Herod Antony had taken, he would have loved thee and thee alone, and left the brown Egyptian clean forsaken, and Cleopatra then to seek had been so firm a lover of her waned face.
Yes, there it is. That's the confirmation that she's a super racist character. She's Yoko Ono-ing Cleopatra now. If Mark Antony had married Mariam, then he wouldn't have fallen.
Then great Anthonius' fall we had not seen, by her that fled to have him hold the chase. Then Mariam in a Roman's chariot set in place of Cleopatra might have shown a mart of beauties in her visage met, and part in this that they were all her own.
Now, this speech is, of course, bonkers. It clearly was a fantasy that has gotten out of all proportion. Alexandra has become trapped in a world of what-if, of regrets and hates, and pours it out in attacking Mariam, in the dynasty of Herod, in racist slurs, in grief. It's an amazing speech. it is also utterly, vitally cuttable. It's just too long this early in the action. It's too tangential. It's really weird. And it also sets up nothing really useful dramaturgically. There are themes and ideas here that will get reshaped and reused later. I know why it's there. But we're not going to see Alexandra again. And that is the frustrating element of this play, is that certain things are set up that don't necessarily fully play out later on. It's really useful for actors to understand the court, the character, the relationship Mariam has with people, in part influenced by her mother, which is why it is here in its entirety in this spoilers episode, and why I've talked about it at some length. But it is just too much. It has not survived into the final cut, at least not at this stage, unless I suddenly have a turnaround. If you can persuade me, I might try and put it back in. I might use the material somewhere else, because in the final cut I might do some movement of material. Mariam must have heard this story 100 times. I mean, it's just mortifying, really, isn't it? It's like, I brought Mark Antony round the house once and she won't stop mentioning him. You can't say things like that, Mother. Or at least that's how we discussed it in rehearsal.
Stop mentioning Cleopatra. I don't care about her.
Mom. Yes, it is like that. Yeah. I don't want to go too far down that route. Yeah. But it is
the kind of, Cleopatra.
It's the kind of thing that would happen in body language rather than text. Is that something?
It's usually Cleopatra.
Family's the worst.
Yeah.
She had no interest in the weird Mark Antony thing, if for no other reason than everybody died.
Not to be Empress of aspiring Rome. Would Mariam like to Cleopatra live? With purest body will I press my tomb, and wish no favours Antony could give.
Alexandra, perhaps seeing the flaw in her own argument, decides it's time to withdraw. But before they can exit, the stage is destabilised with the entrance of another character. Mariam, our titular figure, is going to be upstaged shortly by the entrance of Salome. Because Salome is going to destabilise this whole story somewhat rotten. The king is possibly dead. Salome, the king's sister, enters to find these two upstarts talking. Actual tears on the face are long gone from Mariam, but Salome can see a sparkle of water in the eyes of her enemies and misinterprets them.
More plotting yet? Why, now you have the thing for which so oft you spent your suppliant breath. And Mariam hopes to have another king. Her eyes do sparkle joy for Herod's death.
This ironically unfair attack on Mariam receives a swift rebuttal from Alexandra. Salome parries with a crack at Mariam's place in the court.
You durst not thus have given your tongue the rein, if noble Herod still remained in life. Your daughter's betters far, I dare maintain, might have rejoiced to be my brother's wife.
And that gets to Mariam. It gives her a chance to display her own snobbery to this upstart royal.
My betters far? Pace, woman, 'tis untrue. You scarce have ever my superiors seen. For Mariam's servants were as good as you before she came to be Judea's queen.
Which just confirms Salome's opinion of her.
Now stirs the tongue that is so quickly moved. But more than once your choler have I borne. Your fumish words are sooner said than proved, and Salome's reply is only scorn.
Because it's an interesting question. If Salome, being the sister of the king and descended from a king before, has lived effectively as a royal, whereas Mariam has a better line of descent, but is not necessarily from as big a household. But it seems that Mariam has always been quite horrid to Salome.
Scorn those that are for thy companions held. Though I thy brother's face had never seen, my birth, thy baser birth, so far excelled, I had to both of you the princess been.
The attack moves on to actions, not ancestry, putting Salome onto the back foot. I mean, she did kind of have her first husband killed. And that's a big thing, however justified.
With thy black acts I'll not pollute my breath, else to thy charge I might full justly lay a shameful life, besides a husband's death.
'Tis true indeed. I did the plots reveal that passed betwixt your favourites and you. I meant not I, a traitor, to conceal. Thus Salome your minion Joseph slew.
Heaven, dost thou mean this infamy to smother? Let slandered Mariam ope thy closed ear. Self-guilt hath ever been suspicion's mother, and therefore I this speech with patience bear.
Again, Mariam trying to hold the moral high ground, but she can't leave it there. She says she's going to leave it there, but she doesn't. She goes on, a bit like her mother, perhaps.
No, had not Salome's unsteadfast heart in Joseph's stead her Constabaris placed. To free herself she had not used the art to slander hapless Mariam for unchaste.
Come, Mariam, let us go. It is no boot to let the head contend against the foot.
Ooh, ouch. And off they jolly well wend. Though she gets a name check, we won't see Alexandra again. Possibly we're quite glad about that. Salome is left alone, and this is structurally how this act functions, with solo turns joined, forcing a changing of the guard. Mariam started alone, joined by her mother, who, arguing, joined forces to face the entrance of Salome, who then holds the field, forcing them off. For now. And now we hear the inner life of the possibly slandered Salome. We've been told she's a bit murdery, perhaps, and of a lower status, but possibly also higher status family. Confusing. Now we're going to hear her side, starting in response to that parting insult.
It is no boot to let the head contend against the foot.
Live Salome to get so base a style as foot to the proud Mariam. Herod's spirit in happy time for her endured exile. For did he live, she should not miss her merit. But he is dead, and though he were my brother, his death such store of cinders cannot cast my coals of love to quench. For though they smother the flames a while, yet will they out at last.
And that's an interesting drift. She's upset that Mariam appeared unmoved by the probable death of her brother, but she admits she can't stay focused on her grief either. There is grief. I think she does actually care about her brother, but she's more thinking of her love for an Arabian prince, Silius.
Oh, blessed Arabia, in best climate placed. I by the fruit will censure of the tree. 'Tis not in vain the happy name thou hast, if all Arabians like Silius be.
And here she muses on the issue raised by Mariam and Alexandra. Her marriage to Josephus ended by his death, which she sort of arranged, because she fell in love with Constabaris. Now she loves another, and again she can't divorce.
Had not my fate been too contrary, when I on Constabaris first did gaze, Silius had been object to mine eye, whose looks and personage must all eyes amaze. But now, ill-fated Salome, thy tongue to Constabaris by itself is tied. And now, except I do the Hebrew wrong, I cannot be the fair Arabian's bride.
And she makes the fair point that not being able to divorce him, though her husband can divorce her, is not just unjust, it's stupid.
What childish lets are these? Why stand I now on honourable points? 'Tis long ago since shame was written on my tainted brow, and certain 'tis that shame is honour's foe.
So why not publicly sue for divorce anyway? It's not like she has a reputation anymore. Just look at her first husband.
Had I upon my reputation stood, had I affected an unspotted life, Josepha's veins had still been stuffed with blood, and I, to him, had lived a sober wife. Then had I never cast an eye of love on Constabarus' now detested face. Then had I kept my thoughts without remove, and blushed at motion of the least disgrace.
She's long past being embarrassed by her actions. If it weren't for that slight element of the murdery death element in this speech, we're all behind her. Go on, she says, call me difficult or worse.
But shame is gone, and honour wiped away, and impudency on my forehead sits. She bids me work my will without delay, and for my will I will employ my wits.
It's all a pretense, a point of tradition and law, laws which, she's made clear, she has no interest in.
He loves. I love. What then can be the cause keeps me from being the Arabian's wife? It is the principles of Moses' laws, for Constabarus still remains in life. If he, to me, did bear an earnest hate, as I to him, for him though were in ease, a separating bill might free his fate from such a yoke that did so much displease. Why should such privilege to man be given? Or given to them, why barred from women then? Are men than we in greater grace with heaven? Or cannot women hate as well as men?
Cannot women hate as well as men? And then it's that high point of the speech.
I'll be the custom breaker, and begin to show my sex the way to freedom's door.
And just as we've all forgotten the outcome of her last sort of divorce, and have taken up the rightness of her arguments, we're drawn to hints of the dark side of what is now going to happen. If Herod were alive, she could just have her husband killed, because Salome knows something about Constabarus. She has a lever to get him out of her life, and his own.
If Herod had lived, I might to him accuse my present lord. But for the future's sake, then would I tell the king he did refuse the sons of Babas in his power to take.
So instead, she's going to do all she can with the power that she has. She will shame her husband, cast him out, sue for divorce, and curse that she hadn't got rid of him sooner.
But now, I must divorce him from my bed, that my Sylleus may possess his room. Had I not begged his life, he had been dead. I curse my tongue, the hinderer of his doom.
Salome is a political animal. Yes, she has her loves, she has her passions, but she also has no real power, and her status is constantly being undermined. So she's being forced into making some really nasty decisions because her society will not allow her to do what she wants. I suspect at this point some of the audience will like her a great deal more than Mariam. For unlike Mariam, or definitely Alexandra before her, I feel little desire to cut away at this speech. It's just too good. And again, the stage is destabilised by another entrance to the scene. Her lover, Sylleus, arrives. And whilst we've gone for some mild, sexy times in the performance, the dialogue is chaste. It's very praisey. And then immediately into planning. Has she managed to secure a divorce?
Well found, fair Salome, Judea's bride. Athenianated wisdom found the way to make Sylleus deem him deified by gaining thee a more than precious prey.
I have devised the best I can devise. A more imperfect means was never found, but what cares Salome? It doth suffice if our endeavours with their end be crowned.
So a plan has been decided upon to hand him divorce papers herself, or the equivalent.
In this our land we have an ancient use, permitted first by our lawgiver's head. Who hates his wife, though for no just abuse, may with a bill divorce her from his bed. But in this custom women are not free. Yet I for once will rest it.
And then there's this telling line. She asks him not to blame her for the ill she'll do. Is this for the fuss she's about to make, or for something darker?
Blame not thou the ill I do, since what I do's for thee, though others blame, Silius should allow.
Luckily, as far as she's concerned, Silius is a pushover. God, he is so in love. He's like a lovesick little puppy. I don't see this going well further down the line. He so doesn't deserve her.
Think Salome, Silius hath a tongue to censure her for her actions?
Fade, yawn, yawn, vomit, vomit. Various love platitudes pass, maybe leading to some more canoodling. Which is unfortunate because the stage is destabilized again by the entrance of her husband. And if I were staging it, I probably would slightly twist the text a bit. For at this moment, I would make it that she gives Silius a big snog in front of her husband before sending him off.
Who doth here arrive? Oh, 'tis Constabarus that doth hither walk. I'll find a quarrel him from me to drive.
Farewell. But were it not for thy command, in his despite, Silius here would stand.
Now, there is more to say about Silius later, but he exits pretty swiftly here, and it's now time for a row between Constabarus and Salome. Who is Constabarus? Well, he's a fighting man, he's upright, he's traditional, and, well, you'll see.
Oh, Salome, how much you wrong your name, your race, your country, and your husband most. A stranger's private conference is shame. I blush for you that have your blushing lost.
Name, race, country, and husband. In which order of precedence? Which race, which country, which husband? For that matter, which name? Constabarus has a point, if he's seen her canoodling with Silius. But the text suggests talking to any man in private brings her shame. I said he's a traditionalist. Yes, he's a controlling traditionalist. It's a bit like a budget price Herod, actually. Not as obsessy as Herod is about Mariam, but still not good. Still not good.
Oft have I found, and found you to my grief, consorted with this base Arabian here. Heaven knows that you have been my comfort chief. Then do not now my greater plague appear.
All of which points, these are not unreasonable issues here, but then he gets morally. Wife, let me tell you why you should know your place, kind of stuff. Yeah.
Oft with a silent sorrow have I heard how ill Judea's mouth doth censure thee. And did I not thine honour much regard, thou shouldest not be exhorted thus for me. Ah, didst thou but know the worth of honest fame, how much a virtuous woman is esteemed, thou wouldest like hell eschew deserved shame, and seek to be both chaste and chastely deemed.
Because, yeah, it's not enough to be faithful, you have to look it too.
Our wisest prince did say, and true he said, a virtuous woman crowns her husband's head.
To which the correct response is, fuck off. Which Salome shows a surprising amount of fortitude and doesn't say. Instead, she points out that she's the sister to the king, and she's more important than him. And she also includes a threat.
This hand of mine hath lifted up thy head, which many a day ago had fallen full low. Because the sons of Babas are not dead. To me, thou dost both life and fortune owe.
Constabarus controls his anger and again tries to persuade Salome to comply. I think because the threat hits home. She knows about the sons of Babas that you've been keeping hiding. Try to keep her on side, Constabarus.
I prithee, Salome, dismiss this mood. Thou dost not know how ill it fits thy place.
Now here's a telling line. I'm sure he means it, because he just doesn't get it, does he?
My words were all intended for thy good, to raise thine honour and to stop disgrace.
Yep, he went there.
To stop disgrace.
She's going to divorce you, mate.
To stop disgrace. Take thou no care for me. Nay, do thy worst. Thy worst I set not by. No shame of mine is like to light on thee. Thy love and admonitions I defy. Thou shalt no hour longer call me wife. Thy jealousy procures my hate so deep that I from thee do mean to free my life by a divorcing bill before I sleep.
And now Constabarus goes full top gear.
Are Hebrew women now transformed to men? Why do you not as well our battles fight and wear our armour? Suffer this? Oh, and then let all the world be topsy-turvied quite.
The complete clocks. He would probably go on, but Salome thankfully stops him. Don't be confused into thinking this is a conversation.
Hold on your talk till it be time to end. For me, I am resolved it shall be so. Though I be the first that to this course do bend, I shall not be the last. Full well I know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can hear the cheers in the audience. Sometimes you can't beat a character prophesying an actual future thing like that. And Constabarus, having listened to all this stuff about, you know, being a human being, he just loses it.
Why then be witness, heaven, the judge of sins, be witness, spirits that eschew the dark, be witness, angels.
He goes on for quite a while here, though it should be said quite quickly, so it wouldn't last that long. And he calls on his God and his ancestors in dismay, for
you are the first, and will, I hope, be last, that ever sought her husband to divorce.
I mean not to be led by precedent. My will shall be to me instead of law.
I fear me much you will too late repent that you have ever lived so void of awe.
And then the penny drops for Constabarus. They don't normally argue this heatedly, even when they disagree on quite a fundamental thing. Ah, something has prompted the argument, and poor luck to him. For at that same moment as the penny drops, Constabarus sees he could end up like Salome's first husband.
This is Silius, love, that makes you thus reverse all order. You must next be his. But if my thoughts are right, the cause discussed in winning you, he gains no lasting bliss. I was Silius, and not long ago Josephus then was Constabarus now. When you became my friend, you proved his foe. As now for him you break to me your vow.
I think Constabarus has now run out of steam. He knows somewhere deep inside that he's in trouble. He won't relent, but he knows. And he stands and takes this farewell thrust from Salome's wit.
If once I loved you, greater is your debt. For certain 'tis that you deserved it not. And undeserved love we soon forget, and therefore that to me can be no blot. But now, fare ill, my once beloved lord, yet never more beloved than now abhorred.
Sick burn from the exiting fleabag. Sorry, Salome. Now, we judge Constabarus as a git. Because he is. But it's probable, certainly at the start of writing of the play, that he was supposed to be an heroic figure, as is Mariam. He upholds order, tradition. His wife is dangerous and wayward. She wants to upturn the natural order, etc., etc., etc. Obviously, as a modern producer, we can't go there. Doesn't matter if the text had that original intention. I'm not producing that. And I don't think the text actually reads that way at all. I mean, I suspect that even if from the initial intent of the author to make him a hero and marry him a hero, the author was too good not to make them not completely good people. Not uncomplex. So Constabarus loves his wife. He's probably on a day-to-day basis relatively nice. He just can't see why she won't conform in the way that everybody else does. He can't see outside of the box. He can't see that he is part of the problem. He is the reason for the divorce. It's not just about her love for somebody else. In his closing speech, Constabaris effectively waves his love for Salome goodbye. He is done. That was it. I mean, it isn't. But that's now where his love does that nasty, mutatey thing into hate.
Yet Constabaris biddeth thee farewell. Farewell, light creature. Heaven forgive thy sin.
And he sees a possible end for himself. And then he talks plot, filling in for the audience the significance of the youths, the sons of Babas, that he's hidden. He's thankful that Herod is dead, because not only would he fall, but also Mariam, Herod's wife, would fall as well. She wouldn't survive much longer with all that's been going on. So listen to the closing speech of this long scene, and for a moment let the modern view of Constabaris fall away. Because I think this is a good speech to get a sense of how the reader or audience might have seen him as a more heroic figure in the early 17th century.
Though all Judea yield her innocent, she often hath been near to punishment.
That said, he's still a git. But then, other gits are available. So the act ends with a chorus. Chorus, a company of Jews. And they are almost, you could say, Constabaris' cheerleaders. They are so traditional and difficult to take. I mean, either they are supposed to be an extreme view who we as an audience are not supposed to agree with, or the playwright does actually agree with the views that they cast and put forward, that they are the mouthpiece for the author, and then we get a bit sad inside because I'm not a fan of the chorus. And I've not recorded the chorus properly for the full cast audio adaptation, for reasons I'll go into on a spoilers episode that's for a shorter act, which is not quite so setty-uppy. However, I did do an exploring session of the text with Beyond Shakespeare irregular Alan Scott to try and get at the chorus, get a sense of whether it's supposed to be ironic or not, or another piece of counterpoint in a play with many overlapping areas of political discourse. It's probably something in between, but I don't find that I can make that clear either way as an audio piece. There might be bits of the chorus that might survive into the final edit and might get recorded, but at this stage, I'm not a fan. The chorus exploration will follow the plain text recording for Act 1, which is coming up in a moment. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of, not so brief breakdown of this act, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. There are many areas of this particular episode where I feel vastly unqualified and unplaced to be discussing, but I have a crack. Anyway, I certainly might re-edit based on your suggestions. Email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org or give us a buzz on Twitter @beyondshakes. Or you can support our work by becoming a patron. Patrons get to vote for the plays we work on next. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare and get involved. But that's it from this spoiler episode. The full cast super deluxe edit will be coming anon. In Act 1 of this plain text, Gillian Horgan is playing Mariam. Lee MacDonald, her mother Alexandra. Pamela Flanagan, Salome. Simon Nader, Silius, Hayden McCabe, Constabaris, and Alan Scott, working through the chorus with me, your host, Robert Crichton. And this is the plain text edit of Act 1 of The Tragedy of Mariam by Elizabeth Carey. Enjoy.
How oft have I with public voice run on to censure Rome's last hero for deceit? Because he wept when Pompey's life was gone. Yet when he lived, he thought his name too great. But now I do recant. And, Roman lord, excuse too rash a judgment in a woman. My sex pleads pardon then afford. Mistaking is with us but too common. Now do I find, by self-experience taught, one object yields both grief and joy. You wept indeed when on his worth you thought, but joyed that slaughter did your foe destroy. So at his death your eyes true drops did rain, whom dead you did not wish alive again. When Herod lived, that now is done to death, oft have I wished that I from him were free. Oft have I wished that he might lose his breath. Oft have I wished his carcass dead to see. Then rage and scorn had put my love to flight. That love which once on him was firmly set, hate hid his true affection from my sight, and kept my heart from paying him his debt. And blame me not, for Herod's jealousy had power even constancy itself to change. For he, by barring me from liberty, to shun my ranging, taught me first to range. But yet too chaste a scholar was my heart, to learn to love another than my lord. To leave his love, my lessons form a part I quickly learned, the other I abhorred. But now Herod's death to memory doth call, the tender love that he to Marian bare, and mine to him. This makes those rivers fall, which by another thought unmoistened are, for my brother, the lowliest youth that ever did in angel's shape appear. The cruel Herod was not moved to ruth. Then why grieves Mariam Herod's death to hear? Why joy I not, the tongue no more shall speak, that yielded forth my brother's latest doom? Both youth and beauty might thy fury break, and both in him did ill befit a tomb. And worthy grandsire, ill did he requite his high ascent, alone by thee procured, except he murdered thee to free the sprite, which still he thought on earth too long immured. How happy was it that Sahemus' mind was moved to pity my distressed estate? Might Herod's life a trusty servant find, my death to his had been unseparate. These thoughts have power, his death to make me bear, nay more, to wish the news may firmly hold. Yet cannot this repulse some falling tear, that will against my will some grief unfold? And more I owe him for his love to me, the deepest love that ever yet was seen. Yet had I rather much a milkmaid be, than be the monarch of Judea's queen. It was for naught but love he wished his end, might to my death but the vaunt courier prove. But I had rather still be foe than friend to him that saves for hate and kills for love. Hard-hearted Mariam, at thy discontent, what floods of tears have drenched his manly face? How canst thou then so faintly now lament thy truest lover's death, a death's disgrace? Ay, now, mine eyes, you do begin to right the wrongs of your admirer and my lord. Long since you should have put your smiles to flight. Ill doth a widowed eye with joy accord. Why, now, methinks the love I bear him then, when virgin freedom left me unrestrained, doth to my heart begin to creep again. My passion now is far from being feigned. But, tears, fly back and hide you in your banks. You must not be to Alexandra seen. For if my moan be spied, but little thanks shall Mariam have from that incensed queen.
What means these tears? My Mariam doth mistake the news we heard did tell the tyrant's end. What weepest thou for thy brother's murderer's sake? Will ever whiter tear for Herod spend? My curse pursue his breathless trunk and spirit, base Edomite, the damned Esau's heir. Must he ere Jacob's child the crown inherit? Must he, vile wretch, be set in David's chair? No, David's soul within the bosom placed of our forefather Abraham was ashamed. To see his seat with such a toad disgraced, that seat that hath by Judah's race been famed. Thou fatal enemy to royal blood, did not the murder of my boy suffice to stop thy cruel mouth that gaping stood, but must thou dim the mild Hyrcanus' eyes? My gracious father, whose too ready hand did lift this Idumean from the dust, and he, ungrateful caitiff, did withstand the man that did in him most friendly trust. What kingdom's right could cruel Herod claim? Was he not Esau's issue, heir of hell? Then what succession can he have but shame? Did not his ancestor his birthright sell? Oh yes, he doth from Edom's name derive his cruel nature, which with blood is fed, that made him me of sire and son deprive. He ever thirsts for blood, and blood is red. Weepest thou because his love to thee was bent, and readest thou love in crimson characters? Slew he thy friends to work thy heart's content? No, hate may justly call that action hers. He gave the sacred priesthood for thy sake to Aristobulus, yet doomed him dead before his back the ephod warm could make, and ere the mitre settled on his head. Oh, had he given my boy no less than right, the double oil should to his forehead bring a double honour shining doubly bright. His birth anointed him both priest and king, and saw my father and my son he slew to royalise by right your prince-born breath. Was love the cause? Can Mariam deem it true that Mariam gave commandment for her death? I know by fits he showed some signs of love, and yet not love, but raging lunacy. And this his hate to thee may justly prove that sure he hates Hyrcanus' family. Who knows if he, unconstant wavering lord, his love to Doris had renewed again, and that he might his bed to her afford, perchance he wished that Mariam might be slain.
Doris? Alas, her time of love was past. Those coals were raked in embers long ago, in Mariam's love, and she was now disgraced. Nor did I glory in her overthrow. He not a whit his firstborn son esteemed, because as well as his, he was not mine. My children only for his own he deemed. These boys that did descend from royal line, these did he style his heirs to David's throne. My Alexander, if he live, shall sit in the majestic seat of Solomon. To will it so, did Herod think it fit?
Why, who can claim from Alexander's brood that gold-adorned, lion-guarded chair? Was Alexander not of David's blood? And was not Mariam Alexander's heir? What more than right could Herod then bestow? And who will think, except for more than right, he did not raise them? For they were not low, but born to wear the crown in his despite. Then send those tears away that are not sent to thee by reason, but by passion's power. Thine eyes to cheer, thy cheeks to smiles be bent, and entertain with joy this happy hour. Felicity, if when she comes, she finds a mourning habit and a cheerless look, will think she is not welcome to thy mind, and so perchance her lodging will not brook. Oh, keep her whilst thou hast her. If she go, she will not easily return again. Full many a year have I endured in woe, yet still have sued her presence to obtain. And did not I to her as presents send a portrait that best art did beautify of two to whom heaven did best feature lend to woo her love by winning Antony? For when a prince's favour we do crave, we first their minions' loves do seek to win. So I, that sought felicity to have, did with her minion Antony begin. With double sleight I sought to captivate the warlike lover, but I did not right. For if my gift had borne but half the rate, the Roman had been overtaken quite. But now he fared like a hungry guest that to some plenteous festival is gone. Now this, now that he deems to eat were best. Such choice doth make him let them all alone. The boy's large forehead first did fairest seem, then glanced his eye upon my Mariam's cheek, and that without comparison did deem what was in either but he most did like. And thus distracted, either's beauties might within the other's excellence was drowned. Too much delight did bear him from delight, for either's love the other's did confound. Where if thy portraiture had only gone, his life from Herod Antony had taken, he would have loved thee and thee alone, and left the brown Egyptian clean forsaken, and Cleopatra then to seek had been so firm a lover of her waned face. Then great Anthonius' fall we had not seen, by her that fled to have him hold the chase. Then Mariam in a Roman's chariot set in place of Cleopatra might have shown a mart of beauties in her visage met, and part in this that they were all her own.
Not to be empress of aspiring Rome, would Mariam like to Cleopatra live? With purest body will I press my tomb, and wish no favours Anthony could give.
Let us retire us, that we may resolve how now to deal in this reversed state. Greater the affairs that we must now revolve, and great affairs must not be taken late.
More plotting yet? Why, now you have the thing for which so oft you spent your suppliant breath. And Mariam hopes to have another king. Her eyes do sparkle joy for Herod's death.
If she desired another king to have, she might before she came in Herod's bed have had her wish. More kings than one did crave for leave to set a crown upon her head. I think with more than reason she laments that she is freed from such a sad annoy. Whoist will weep to part from discontent? And if she joy, she did not causeless joy.
You durst not thus have given your tongue the rein, if noble Herod still remained in life. Your daughter's betters far, I dare maintain, might have rejoiced to be my brother's wife.
My betters far? Pace, woman, 'tis untrue. You scarce have ever my superiors seen. For Mariam's servants were as good as you before she came to be Judea's queen.
Now stirs the tongue that is so quickly moved. But more than once your choler have I borne. Your fumish words are sooner said than proved, and Salome's reply is only scorn.
Scorn those that are for thy companions held. Though I thy brother's face had never seen, my birth, thy baser birth, so far excelled, I had to both of you the princess been. Thou party Jew, and party Edomite, thou mongrel, issued from rejected race, thy ancestors against the heavens did fight, and thou like them wilt heavenly birth disgrace.
Still twit you me with nothing but my birth. What odds betwixt your ancestors and mine? Both born of Adam, both were made of earth, and both did come from holy Abram's line.
I favour thee when nothing else I say. With thy black acts I'll not pollute my breath, else to thy charge I might full justly lay a shameful life, besides a husband's death.
'Tis true indeed. I did the plots reveal that passed betwixt your favourites and you. I meant not I, a traitor, to conceal. Thus Salome, your minion Joseph, slew.
Heaven, dost thou mean this infamy to smother? Let slandered Mariam ope thy closed ear. Self-guilt hath ever been suspicion's mother, and therefore I this speech with patience bear. No, had not Salome's unsteadfast heart in Joseph's stead her Constabaris placed, to free herself she had not used the art, to slander hapless Mariam for unchaste.
Come, Mariam, let us go. It is no boot to let the head contend against the foot.
Live Salome to get so base a style as foot to the proud Mariam. Herod's spirit in happy time for her endured exile. For did he live, she should not miss her merit. But he is dead, and though he were my brother, his death such store of cinders cannot cast my coals of love to quench. For though they smother the flames a while, yet will they out at last. Oh, blessed Arabia, in best climate placed, I by the fruit will censure of the tree. 'Tis not in vain the happy name thou hast, if all Arabians like Silius be. Had not my fate been too contrary, when I on Constabarus first did gaze, Silius had been object to mine eye, whose looks and personage must all eyes amaze. But now, ill-fated Salome, thy tongue to Constabarus by itself is tied. And now, except I do the Hebrew wrong, I cannot be the fair Arabian's bride. What childish lets are these? Why stand I now on honourable points? 'Tis long ago since shame was written on my tainted brow, and certain 'tis that shame is honour's foe. Had I upon my reputation stood, had I affected an unspotted life, Josephus' veins had still been stuffed with blood, and I to him had lived a sober wife. Then had I never cast an eye of love on Constabarus' now detested face. Then had I kept my thoughts without remove, and blushed at motion of the least disgrace. But shame is gone, and honour wiped away, and impudency on my forehead sits. She bids me work my will without delay, and for my will I will employ my wits. He loves, I love. What then can be the cause keeps me from being the Arabian's wife? It is the principles of Moses' laws, for Constabarus still remains in life. If he, to me, did bear an earnest hate as I to him, for him though were in ease, a separating bill might free his fate from such a yoke that did so much displease. Why should such privilege to man be given, or given to them, why barred from women then? Are men than we in greater grace with heaven, or cannot women hate as well as men? I'll be the custom breaker, and begin to show my sex the way to freedom's door, and with an offering will I purge my sin. The law was made for none but who are poor. If Herod had lived, I might to him accuse my present lord. But for the future's sake, then would I tell the king he did refuse the sons of Babas in his power to take. But now I must divorce him from my bed, that my Silius may possess his room. Had I not begged his life, he had been dead. I curse my tongue, the hinderer of his doom. But then my wandering heart to him was fast, nor did I dream of change. Silius said he would be here. And see, he comes at last. Had I not named him longer, had he stayed.
Well found, fair Salome, Judea's bride. Athenated wisdom found the way to make Silius deem him deified by gaining thee a more than precious prey.
I have devised the best I can devise. A more imperfect means was never found, but what cares Salome? It doth suffice if our endeavours with their end be crowned. In this our land we have an ancient use, permitted first by our lawgiver's head. Who hates his wife, though for no just abuse, may with a bill divorce her from his bed. But in this custom women are not free. Yet I for once will rest it. Blame not thou the ill I do, since what I do's for thee. Though others blame, Silius should allow.
think Salome, Silius, hath a tongue to censure her for her actions? Let my blood bedash my proper brow for such a wrong, that being yours can make even vices good. Arabia, joy, prepare thy earth with green, thou never happy wert indeed till now. Now shall thy ground be trod by beauty's queen. Her foot is destined to depress thy brow. Thou shalt, fair Salome, command as much as if the royal ornament were thine. The weakness of Arabia's king is such, the kingdom is not his so much as mine. My mouth is our Obodus oracle, who thinks not aught but what Silius will. And thou, rare creature, Asia's miracle, should be to me as it, Obodus still.
'Tis not for glory I thy love accept. Judea yields me honor's worthy store. Had not affection in my bosom crept, my native country should my life deplore. Were not Silius he with whom I go, I would not change my Palestine for Rome. Much less would I a glorious state to show, go far to purchase an Arabian tomb.
Far be it from Silius so to think. I know it is thy gratitude requites the love that is in me, and shall not shrink till death do sever me from earth's delights.
But wisht, methinks the wolf is in our talk. Be gone, Silius. Who doth here arrive? Oh, 'tis Constabarus that doth hither walk. I'll find a quarrel him from me to drive.
Farewell. But were it not for thy command, in his despite, Silius here would stand.
Oh, Salome, how much you wrong your name, your race, your country, and your husband most. A stranger's private conference is shame. I blush for you that have your blushing lost. Oft have I found, and found you to my grief, consorted with this base Arabian here. Heaven knows that you have been my comfort chief. Then do not now my greater plague appear. Oh, now by the stately carved edifice that on Mount Sion makes so fair a show, and by the altar fit for sacrifice, I love thee more than thou thyself dost know. Oft with a silent sorrow have I heard how ill Judea's mouth doth censure thee. And did I not thine honour much regard, thou shouldest not be exhorted thus for me. Oh, didst thou but know the worth of honest fame, how much a virtuous woman is esteemed, thou wouldest like hell eschew deserved shame, and seek to be both chaste and chastely deemed. Our wisest prince did say, and true he said, a virtuous woman crowns her husband's head.
Did I for this uprear thy low estate? Did I for this requital beg thy life? That thou hadst forfeited to hapless fate, to be to such a thankless wretch the wife. This hand of mine hath lifted up thy head, which many a day ago had fallen full low, because the sons of Babas are not dead. To me thou dost both life and fortune owe.
You have my patience often exercised. Oh, youths, make my collar keep within the banks. Yet boast no more, but be by me advised. A benefit upbraided forfeits thanks. I prithee, Salome, dismiss this mood. Thou dost not know how ill it fits thy place. My words were all intended for thy good, to raise thine honour and to stop disgrace.
To stop disgrace. To stop disgrace. Take thou no care for me. Nay, do thy worst. Thy worst I set not by. No shame of mine is like to light on thee. Thy love and admonitions I defy. Thou shalt no hour longer call me wife. Thy jealousy procures my hate so deep that I from thee do mean to free my life by a divorcing bill before I sleep.
Are Hebrew women now transformed to men? Why do you not as well our battles fight? and wear our armour. Suffer this? Oh, and then let all the world be topsy-turvied quite. Let fishes graze, beasts swim, and birds descend. Let fire burn downwards while the earth aspires. Let winter's heat and summer's cold offend. Let thistles grow on vines and grapes on briars. Oh, set us to spin or sew, or at the best make us wood-hewers, water-bearing wights. For sacred service let us take no rest. Use us as Joshua did the Gibeonites.
Hold on your talk, till it be time to end. For me I am resolved it shall be so. Though I be the first that to this course do bend, I shall not be the last. Full well I know.
Why then be witness, heaven, the judge of sins, be witness, spirits that eschew the dark, be witness, angels, witness, cherubims, whose semblance sits upon the holy ark, be witness, earth, be witness, Palestine, be witness, David's city, if my heart did ever merit such an act of thine, or if the fault be mine that makes us part. Since mildest Moses, friend unto the Lord, did work his wonders in the land of Ham, and slew the firstborn babes without a sword, in sign whereof we eat the holy lamb. Till now that 1400 years are past, since first the law with us hath been in force, you are the first, and will, I hope, be last, that ever sought her husband to divorce.
I mean not to be led by precedent. My will shall be to me instead of law.
I fear me much you will too late repent that you have ever lived so void of awe. This is Silius love that makes you thus reverse all order. You must next be his. But if my thoughts are right, the cause discussed in winning you, he gains no lasting bliss. I was Silius. And not long ago, Josephus then was Constabarus now. When you became my friend, you proved his foe. As now for him, you break to me your vow.
If once I loved you, greater is your debt. For certain 'tis that you deserved it not. And undeserved love we soon forget. And therefore that to me can be no blot. But now, fare ill, my once beloved lord, yet never more beloved than now abhorred.
Yet Constabarus biddeth thee farewell. Farewell, light creature. Heaven forgive thy sin. My prophesying spirit doth foretell, thy wavering thoughts do yet but new begin. Yet I have better scaped than Joseph did. But if our Herod's death had been delayed, the valiant youths that I so long have hid had been by her and I for them betrayed. Therefore, in happy hour did Caesar give the fatal blow to wanton Antony. For had he lived, our Herod then should live. But great Anthonius' death made Herod die. Had he enjoyed his breath, not I alone had been in danger of a deadly fall, but Mariam had the way of peril gone, though by the tyrant most beloved of all. The sweet-faced Mariam, as free from guilt as heaven from spots, yet had her lord come back, her purest blood had been unjustly spilt, and Salome it was would work her wrack. Oh! Though all Judea yield her innocent, she often hath been near to punishment.
The problem with choruses like this, that break up act structures, is they make the audience aware, right, we're one-fifth of the play down now, and it makes the audience aware of time, and it just slightly stops the action, and it becomes a timing device, and therefore it makes the show feel longer. And the chorus has a dramatic function. It's useful to have a chorus because you can comment on the material. It is a bit tricksy, the first read.
Mm.
This is what I find with everyone, is the first time they read it, they go, what? I don't know about the chorus. Mm. The chorus may be written in a different register.
I must admit, when I read it through, I found that it did seem to flow.
Oh, it flows well, but it's very a lot of it's very florid, and sometimes it makes references that are very, very obscure. And you have to go, what the hell am I actually saying? Oh, right. So, first act, what's happened here is Herod has been sent to Rome, and everyone assumes that he's dead.
Right.
So there's a massive power vacuum in the household. There's a lot of plot in what is essentially one very long extended scene of people bustling in and out of the...
That's in the first, ten pages or
that's,
so.
That's the first, in this formatting, 10 pages of the script. And then we come into the chorus. So that's the context of you. Give us a read. Stop and start if we need to, but let's just see how it goes.
Okay. Those minds that wholly dote on upon delight, except they only joy in inward good, still hope at last to hop upon the right, and so from sand they leap in loathsome mud. Fond wretches, seeking what they cannot find, for no content attends a wavering mind. If wealth they do desire, and wealth attain, then wondrous fain would they to honour leap. If mean degree they do in honour gain, they would but wish a little higher step. Thus step to step, and wealth to wealth they add, yet cannot all their plenty make them glad. Yet oft we see that some in humble state are cheerful, pleasant, happy, and content, when those indeed that are of higher state with vain additions do their thoughts torment. To one would to his mind his fortune bind, t'other to his fortune frames his mind. To wish variety is sign of grief. For if you like your state as now it is, why should an alteration bring relief? Nay, change would then be feared as loss of bliss, that man is only happy in his fate, that is delighted in a settled state. Still Mariam wished she from her lord were free, for expectation of variety. Yet now she sees her wishes prosperous be, she grieves because her lord so soon did die. Who can those vast imaginations feed, wherein a property contempt doth breed? Were Herod now perchance to live again, she would again as much be grieved at that. All that she may, she ever doth disdain. Her wishes guide her to she knows not what, and sad must be their looks, their honour sour, that care for nothing being in their power.
It's one of those things that the chorus starts almost in that abstract vein, discussing the theme,
yeah,
before actually relating it to the play, the scene that we have watched.
Yes.
So for the listener, or for my, I really zoned out for the first four stanzas until still Mariam wished and going, ah!
Yeah.
That's sorry, what we're talking about.
Where are you putting these stanza breaks?
Ah, I can, if you look, it's every six lines.
Six line stanza.
Yeah, it's...
Yes, I mean the first four are all generalisations.
Mm.
I mean, some of which actually do make quite a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And then the last two stanzas are the ones
where it's effectively joining it into the play itself.
Into what's already happened.
Mm. So let's take it stanza by stanza then. Let's just give me that first stanza again as beautifully as you can.
Those minds that wholly dote upon delight, except they only joy in inward good, still hope at last to hop upon the right, and so from sand they leap in loathsome mud. Fond wretches, seeking what they cannot find, for no content attends a wavering mind.
Okay, so what's going on there? Is it leaping from, is it frying? Because so from sand, which is a treacherous position, to mud, which is another
even worse.
Yeah, so it's
frying pan of fire.
Frying
isn't
pan
it?
Of fire, isn't it? So we got minds that dote upon delight. So there are some minds dote upon delight, unless, except they only joy in inward good. They're only interested in their own...
Hedonism versus contemplation.
Yeah, it's Apollo versus Dionysus. What this person is, this is a gadfly, isn't it? Someone who's leaping from thing to thing.
Yeah.
Upon their mood. And they're always hoping to hit on the right thing that's going to make them happy. Hop upon the right. And so from sand they leap in loathsome mud. And because they're just leaping about, they end up in the shit. Fond wretches... seeking what they cannot find, for no content attends a wavering mind. Now, I don't want to make a pronunciation. I mean, is that referring to anyone specifically in the play yet? I don't know if it feels quite right for Mariam, you see, herself, because she's not a gadfly in that sense.
I
mean, there's a talk about emotions and where she should be feeling and what her proper feeling should be, but it doesn't quite fit her. It also doesn't quite fit Salome either.
I wonder whether this is a sort of more general...
Yeah, it's meditation
on ethics, almost.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's sort of why it just didn't grab me, shall we say. Because I didn't know what this speaker was doing. Let's go for the next stanza.
Second stanza.
Yeah.
Okay. If wealth they do desire and wealth attain, then wondrous fain would they to honour leap. If mean degree they do in honour gain, they would but wish a little higher step. Thus step to step and wealth to wealth they add, yet cannot all their plenty make them glad.
So it's an expansion of basically the same thing. An example being, if it was wealth we're talking about, this is what they would do.
Or honour.
Yeah, wealth or honour. You know, so that you've got, but basically, this is the vague theme in the first one about, you know, not wanting to, you know, being a gadfly, as it were. These are some practical examples of what that really means.
Mm.
Do that one again, please.
Yeah, sure. If wealth they do desire and wealth attain, then wondrous fain would they to honour leap. If mean degree they do in honour gain, they would but wish a little higher step. Thus step to step and wealth to wealth they add, yet cannot all their plenty make them glad.
So, carry on. Let's go into the third.
Yet oft we see that some in humble state are cheerful, pleasant, happy and content, when those indeed that are of higher state with vain additions do their thoughts torment. To one would to his mind his fortune bind, t'other to his fortune frames his mind.
So, that's going in a different direction. So, some in humble state. The poorer people are cheerful, pleasant, happy and content. That's always one of those lovely lies. And you see all those poor people in those countries, they're always smiling, they're always happy.
You know, peasants know your place.
Well, I wouldn't, it's more, I think, that the poor just don't know how awful it is for the rich. You know, we live in torment, or, you know, we may have all the lovely things, but we're really sad inside. Because it's, you know, when those indeed that are of higher state with vain additions do their thoughts torment. So, you know, wealth doesn't make you happy.
No, but it can't half assuage the pain.
Yeah, it does. I think, to quote one learned philosopher, wealth doesn't make you happy, but it does buy you a lot of shoes. The one would, to his mind, his fortune bind. That's presumably the poor.
No, you're talking about those of higher state.
Well, it's the one and t'other. So which is the one and which is the t'other? So it's the one would logically be the first one and the t'other would be the second.
Yeah, that...
But I don't know what the one line really means.
I think, in fact, what you've got is fortune being used in two different senses.
Mm.
What you're actually saying is the one, the poor...
Mm.
The one who's in humble state,
yes,
is thinking about his everlasting fortune,
mm,
potential redemption, afterlife.
Well, I don't know.
All that sort of stuff. The other one is using fortune in the more common modern usage of...
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, the stress is here. So the one would, to his mind, his fortune bind. So I think that he's, you know, the poor is...
Yeah, so I think the thing is that the emphasis has got to be on mind.
Yeah, it's on
in the penultimate line. And fortune
in the following line. The other two, his fortune frames his mind. So the one's thinking, it's that thing of, you know, thinking about worthwhile things.
Well, it's intellectual advancement or financial advancement.
It's still a slightly odd thought. And it's not very clear, because I think that could be passed in different ways. I think we're probably right. Let's go on to stanza four. I think we got the basic idea what's going on, so let's see where it's going, because we're about to go to a specific example within the play.
Can we just do three again with a little, if I change the emphasis very slightly on that?
Absolutely.
Yet oft we see that some in humble state are cheerful, pleasant, happy, and content, when those indeed that are of higher state with vain additions do their thoughts torment. The one would to his mind his fortune bind, t'other to his fortune frames his mind.
That emphasis works.
You see where I'm going with that?
Yes. That works.
Right, stanza four. To wish variety is sign of grief, for if you like your state as now it is, why should an alteration bring relief? Nay, change would then be feared as loss of bliss. That man is only happy in his fate that is delighted in a settled state.
So that's definitely the anti-gadfly approach has been elaborated upon. So, you know, to wish variety is a sign of grief, which is a very interesting way of putting it.
But again, it's reinforcing
my view
of, you know, be content with your lot.
Yeah, well, it's that thing of, but it's also, it's not just content with your lot, it's that thing of, again, it's the wealthy person who's leaping from one thing to another, because they can, actually. I mean, that's the reason why they're doing it.
Yeah.
And again, those final two lines of the stanza, the C lines, that man is only happy in his fate that is delighted in a settled state. It's like you've got these little, you've got the first four lines, and then the last two are sort of doing the homily.
Yeah.
At the end to sum up.
Yes, I mean, they could almost...
They're almost all isolational. Okay, now the author attempts to connect it to the play.
Still Mariam wished she from her lord were free for expectation of variety. Yet now she sees her wishes prosperous be. She grieves because her lord so soon did die. Who can those vast imaginations feed, wherein a property contempt doth breed?
Now that's the really weird line.
Yeah.
So still Marian wishes she from her lord were free for expectation of variety. I don't think that's true. I don't think literally that happened in the in this act. I don't think Marian is going, she wished from her lord to be free for expectation of variety. I think he wished to be free because he was a bastard. And lots of good reasons. So the thing is, this chorus is supposed to be a chorus of learned Jews, I think it is.
Oh, right. It's multiple voices rather than single.
Well, we don't know whether the chorus would have been thought of. It's a company of Jews, yes, so it would have been a multiple voice.
Mm.
But the thing is, if they are the voice, shall we say, of the patriarchy, they might be saying a ostensibly different thing to what we've just watched. That there might be a deliberate point from the author of saying, well, you've just watched the drama of people saying, I want to be free from these horrible men, and then a chorus of men come on and say, well, they just can't choose what they want, can they? And it's almost a satire.
And it is a radical change that you're moving very much from the general into the particular, aren't you?
Yeah, it's well, I think, and I suspect this is what we'll see in the other choruses as well, is that it starts off with a general homily and then tries to bring it down to...
And now back to the plot.
This is how it connects. This is where this theme connects to the plot. Whether this is true or not is a separate issue entirely. Do that one again and then run it into the final stanza, please.
Okay. Still Mariam wished she from her lord were free for expectation of variety. Yet now she sees her wishes prosperous be. She grieves because her lord so soon did die. Who can those vast imaginations feed wherein a property contempt doth breed? Were Herod now perchance to live again, she would again be as much be grieved at that. All that she may, she ever doth disdain. Her wishes guide her to know, to she knows not what. And sad must be their looks, their honour sour, that care for nothing being in their power.
So again, it gives her a different motivation for what may happen, in that we know this is what's going to happen. You know, were Herod now perchance to live again,
you do, again... I don't, I haven't read ahead.
Yeah. But it's suggesting that if he turns out to be alive, she will be grieved again. Yeah. And the reason, which is true, but it's giving her again the motivation of, because, you know, she's a gadfly and she doesn't know what she... Because it does seem to be the chorus is being really patronising slash a bit evil. So, yeah, spoiler alert, Herod is alive. There is a question of how she then reconciles his still being aliveness to what comes later. Just do that final speech again, please.
What, the last stanza?
Just the last stanza.
Were Herod now perchance to live again, she would again as much be grieved at that. All that she may, she ever doth disdain. Her wishes guide her to she knows not what. And sad must be their looks, their honour sour, that care for nothing being in their power. Yeah, I think that...
What the hell does that mean?
I think it's more a question of fitting the rhyme scheme rather than actually necessarily making an awful lot of sense.
I think it's striving to mean something. It just doesn't have all the data points in there for the length of the line. Who are they? I know it's probably a generic thing. In their power. So it must be their looks, their honour sour, that care for nothing being in somebody else's power.
I think
is that on her side?
Well, no, it's her wishes. So I think there refers to her wishes.
Yeah, but there's three theirs, and I don't think they're all the same there. Sad must be their looks, i.e. her, their honour sour, her, that care for nothing being in there. Who is that there? That can't be the same there.
It must be her power, effectively.
Well, it can't be, because
no,
if it's their looks and their honour sour, I don't know how to pass that line.
No, it...
I think, you know, there was a thought. Let's go on to the next one.